This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
I'm with Professor Sanjeev Gupta from Imperial College London. Hello, and thank you for joining us.
Hi there.
And you are giving a public lecture later on the Mars rover Curiosity. Can you tell us a little bit about Curiosity?
Well, it's pretty amazing. Here we are on a beautiful sunny day in St. Andrews, and Mars today is very, very cold, and not a lot going on. Curiosity is all about looking at past and ancient environments on Mars. So its key task is to look at rock successions on Mars and try to infer from looking at those rock successions what the ancient environments on Mars were like and whether they were, as has been hypothesized, environments that were warm and wet, so that liquid water had once flowed on the surface of Mars. So Curiosity is an amazing machine because it's a geologist and a geochemist together. I actually worry that perhaps one day us field geologists will lose our jobs because these robots are so amazing. But it has a wide array of instruments on board. So lots of cameras which act as the eyes of the rover, which help us, you know, drive and direct us to what we want to look at. But in addition, it's got all these amazing chemistry instruments that can analyze the chemistry of the rocks in a variety of different ways, including some entirely new ways that haven't been done on other planets before, to try and reconstruct these past conditions on Mars.
Okay, so one thing you mentioned there was about rock successions. Kind of, what do you mean by rock successions? Is it kind of layers of rock or?
Yeah, so the history of, for example, Earth's surface is actually recorded in rock layers. And we've all walked on beaches, maybe in Dorset and other places, where you can see these successions of rocks. And these rocks basically are time machines. They're recording the surface evolution of Earth through time. And geologists use their knowledge to try and infer, you know, was this rock deposited by an ancient river? Was it in an ancient lake? Or was this by a volcanic ash flow, for example? And we're quite good at that now. We've been doing this now for several hundred years. And we now have a really good picture of the evolution of Earth for the last few billion years. The next step is really starting to do this on other planets. And what the early rovers, the MER rovers, showed us, what there were rock successions, and what Curiosity is really doing remarkably is trying to build up this picture and try to build up this paleo-environmental history, this ancient environmental history, for the first time on Mars.
So it's up there, and it's got all these kind of different instruments, but how does it actually kind of go about telling you this information? Does it take rock samples, analyze them, or is it something else?
Oh, it does all sorts of things, and it's a very, very complex procedure. I'm amazed by how complex it is. And it's very different. Those of you used to orbital missions, for example, where, you know, there's different instrument teams and you do your job of collecting that data. Here, this actually requires integration of the whole science team and all the engineers involved in carrying out these tasks and making sure the instruments work, etc. So what would happen normally is that we first work with the camera data. So the first thing when we get to a new place, we take navigation camera data. These are stereo images that allow us to construct the terrain and produce a digital terrain map, sorry, an elevation map.
By stereo images, so you mean it kind of like two cameras, so like our own eyes, so you get depth perception.
That's right, and that's very, very important to us as geologists, because we want to know obviously how far things are, but we also want to reconstruct the thicknesses and the distances of rock units. So navigation cameras are stereo cameras, and those are mainly for, as I've said, navigation purposes, and that's what we use to pick the rock targets that we want to start analyzing. There's a lot of rock on Mars, so, you know, and we're always under pressure to keep moving. There's a lot of science to do, and we're always worrying that the rover might break tomorrow. So we're trying to maximize the science, so we don't ever waste any moment or any minutes of the day. So once we have the navigation cameras down, the team will then think about what targets they want to pick and what images they want to get. So the next step would be to get photographs, images from our MouseCam cameras. These are the geologist tools, and these are color images, very high resolution. And again, we have stereo images. We have two cameras there. And these allow us kilometers to meter scale views of the landscape, but also of the rock bodies. And we start, as geologists, we start analyzing these images and reconstructing the geological history using these, but also helps us direct which direction we want to go. As I said, you know, there's a lot of rock on Mars and you've got to pick. And you've got, it's often hunches, you know, you say, well, this looks interesting. I see some layers over there. That could be a good place to go to. And we'll argue and debate this. And then we'll decide we'll drive in that direction. And then as you drive closer and closer to a target, you'll get more and more images closer and you start seeing more detail.
Do you pick particularly large rocks, or is it a hint of a pattern, or is it anything particularly unusual about it?
Well, because curiosity is a mission about habitability, so it's looking at layers in terms of the ancient environments, we're really looking at sedimentary rocks. That's what we're really interested in. So the first thing we look for is layering, because layering is a key sign of perhaps sorting by water or by air. And then as we get closer and as we're at an outcrop, if it looks really interesting, we will then start doing drilling activities. And that's what we've actually spent much of the last 6 months doing, is we found some very interesting rocks, mudstones. And this was partly an engineering task, but first drilling activities on another planet. So huge operation. But also, obviously, we chose a scientifically interesting rock. And I mean, in addition to all the cameras, the geochemistry instruments, there's some remote geochemistry instruments. So one of these is a laser, the ChemCam laser, and this can shoot a laser pulse up to 7 meters away and produce a plasma in the rock. And it looks at the spectra in that plasma. And, you know, it's a semi-quantitative measure of the elemental chemistry.
It can do that from that far away.
Yeah, 7 meters. And so we use this as a remote sensing tool, basically. And it's great to have because we can't, again, look at every single rock. Then there's an alpha particle X-ray spectrometer that, again, gives us another remote sensing tool, gives us elemental chemistry. And that's been on previous rovers, for example. What's really new with Curiosity is that it has the ability to ingest material.
Ingest material?
Yes. It can take soil or rock powder and take it inside Curiosity and put it into two amazing instruments. So the first instrument is called ChemIn, and that's X-ray diffraction. So X-ray diffraction, you're basically passing X-rays through minerals, and because minerals have a particular crystal structure, the X-rays will diffract in particular ways. So what we can do with this is that we're not guessing the mineralogy. This gives us the precise mineralogy and the proportions of different minerals in a rock. And this is the first time this has ever been done. Almost, we did the first X-ray diffraction almost 100 years to the day that it was done on Earth by the Braggs in Manchester. So, you know, we weren't surprised by the results. Obviously, Mars is a basaltic planet. It's a volcanic planet. So, you know, we have olivines and all these other volcanic minerals. But to have that accurately was great, and it wasn't model-driven. The other amazing instrument, and this is astonishing, it's about the size of a large microwave oven, and it has three mass spectrometers in it. It's called SAM, Sample Analysis at Mars. And what this does is it takes in sample, so it could be rock powder from our drilling activities or soil collected, and it's put into a crucible, and it's then heated up to very, very high temperatures, and this analyzes the gases given off. So obviously, you know, missions to Mars are all about discovering not just habitability, but obviously discovering evidence for past life. We're not there yet at the moment, but we're looking for complex organic compounds. And so these gases, if there were complex organic compounds present in the rock or the soil, we would be able to detect that with SAM. So finding complex organic compounds, so these are long chain carbon, you know, things, wouldn't be evidence for life, but it's a hint that we're getting closer. So you can form these compounds by different methods, etc. So it doesn't mean in situ life was present, but you know, it's a step-by-step process.
Okay. And does it do it all entirely automatically, or does it have to kind of be remote controlled to do this?
No, we have to command everything. It's so complex, and what we don't want to have happen is something goes wrong with the command. So everything is very, very carefully triaged, and that's a complex procedure. You know, running SAM is really, really difficult. And obviously they want to change the temperature settings, how high, and different ways of modeling it. So it's a very complex procedure. And it's just amazing how the team interacts and works on this.
Is there any issue with the delay that would be sent, like from signals going to Mars and back again?
Okay, so we don't work in real time. So there is obviously a delay. We don't work in real time. What actually happens is that, for example, as a geologist, I would suggest a series of activities that we could do, and maybe take photographs of a rock outcrop, maybe look at the rock outcrop with our hand lens camera, for example. And then these are turned into a sequence of commands by the engineers, which are then uplinked to the rover, and then these are carried out the next day on Mars, basically. So we don't do it in real time.
Okay, so yeah, they're all, the commands are all kind of stored. Yeah.
And then we get the data coming back the next day or the following day, so we can see how it worked out.
Okay, that's amazing that you can do that so far away. How long has Curiosity actually been on Mars carrying out all these this exploration?
So we're actually coming up to our one-year anniversary. So it landed on the 6th of August last year. So it's pretty amazing that we've almost been there for a year and getting amazing results.
How long is it expected to be there?
So it's actually powered by a plutonium battery. So, I mean, the limitation on the previous rovers, which actually went on for a very, very long time, was that they were powered by solar panels. So with a plutonium battery, it could go on for a very, very long time. It's likely that the other instruments will wear out. But in a sense, we don't really think about that. There's so many things that could possibly go wrong. You know, could have a mobility failure, a wheel could break, or we could run into a rock or something like that. I mean, there are lots of fail-safes. So, you know, we can't, it's difficult to drive into a large rock because the whole rover goes into safe mode. But we basically live each day as it comes, and we try and maximize the science we can gain each day because there's so much to do.
Did it land in a particular place so that there was particular rock formations there?
Okay, yeah, absolutely. And this is a very, very careful process. You know, you have to remember that this rover cost $2.7 billion. It's the most expensive space mission ever and the most complex. So there was a whole process lasting a few years of landing site selection. And this was a sort of public science thing that any scientists who wanted to propose, you know, working on Mars or whatever, who wanted to propose a landing site could do so. And they would start it off with 50, something like 50 landing sites. Then people gave talks about this. And, you know, the people in the audience would discuss this and discuss the priorities and the pros and cons. And this was, you know, people would have votes on these landing sites, and eventually got whittled down to four landing sites. And we went through all of the four landing sites. I'd actually been working on one of the other ones that wasn't selected, but they chose Gale Crater. So Gale Crater is the landing site. It's a crater that's 120 kilometers wide, sits on the near the equator on the Martian dichotomy. And it's a very, very interesting crater. And the reason we've gone there is that in the middle of this crater, there is a mountain 5 kilometers high that's made out of what appear to be layered sedimentary rocks. And we have very, very high resolution images of Mars now. You can see blocks of rocks that are 2 meters in diameter from these orbital images. And so we were able to do a lot of the planning off the landing sites and look at interesting places that geologists would like to go to prior to landing. And obviously, geologists like to go to really rough terrain with lots of cliffs, and engineers don't like to go to those places. But Gale was great, and because the mission had this very specific landing system, this incredible landing system, we could actually define a very narrow ellipse for landing, which was a flat plane within the, you know, in this, on the sides of Gale Crater, within between the rim and the central mountain in the middle of Gale Crater.
You mentioned it had quite a specialised landing system. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, so it was the whole procedure was called by NASA the 7 minutes of terror. Basically, what they did, obviously Mars has a very thin atmosphere, so it's difficult to slow a lander down with just a parachute. And previous missions have used airbags, and the trouble with airbags is you can't predict where they're going to go, so you can't have a narrow ellipse. So what they had is they had this system where once the parachute was jettisoned, the landing craft, which was holding the rover, actually had retro rockets holding it in place, and the rover was actually lowered down to the surface on nylon tethers.
Nylon tethers?
That's right. So they called this the sky crane, and, you know, obviously, they couldn't test this on Earth, so it was just incredible. I'm not sure the science team believed it would work, but it was just an incredible experience to be there and have this happen successfully.
That's incredible that they can do that, because I know that before it was airbags, and then they bounce and all this sort of stuff. So it's been there for about a year now. Are there any science results, any preliminary results from the rover?
Yeah, there have been some pretty amazing results. And, you know, early results are often serendipitous. But again, because we had the orbital imagery, we were able to make predictions. And the one thing that all the geologists on the team were doing in the months prior to landing was actually using the orbital images to make a geological map. And obviously, because we didn't know exactly where we would land, we all had the little squares that we mapped. And that allowed us to be able to predict anywhere in the landing ellipse where there was some interesting geology that we could go and look at. So once we landed, we had to make a decision of where we were going to do the first science. And some people wanted to go and drive straight to the mountain, but that would have been a long time of driving without doing any science, and it would have been a bit boring, really. And what we saw in close to the landing site were some layered rocks. Still a drive, you know, about 500 meters, so that's quite a distance for a rover to drive on terrain when you haven't been driving. So we started driving towards that, and very soon, almost in the first month, we discovered these rock layers. And what's very interesting with this was that actually we often took pictures, because we couldn't really see the rock layers from the navigation camera images, and we would take pictures. And then after we'd driven away, we would find out what was in the pictures. And what we discovered was that these rock layers contained rounded pebbles.
Rounded pebbles.
Yeah, so pebbles are, you know, a few centimetres in diameter, and this is what a rock that geologists call a conglomerate. And the paper on this has just come out, actually, a few weeks ago, and that's the first science paper from Curiosity. So one gets rounding in pebbles. So when you look at the surface of Mars, most of the rocks are angular because they've been made by, you know, impacts, basically, you know, meteorites impacting the surface, breaking up the rocks into small fragments, but these are all angular. Rounding occurs when there's fluid flow and abrasion of the particles of the clasts. And this is a classic feature that we find in rivers on Earth. Now, these pebbles are too large to have been moved by wind action, so it's difficult to infer any other process but by water transport.
So it's evidence for there being water, or at least some sort of liquid flowing.
Yeah. And, you know, we know that there's water ice on Mars. There's no present-day liquid water. Now, because this is in a rock rather than just loose, this tells us that this was actually not in the present-day Mars or recent past, but actually a long time ago, maybe several billion years ago. So what it's telling us, and, you know, these are very, very simple observations for geologists, like, oh. In fact, you know, at first we thought, well, this is pretty basic, you know. What's so exciting about this? And then it took us a bit of time to that. Oh, wow, this is the first time. You know, we've all had, you know, sometimes you hear this, you know, oh, it's water on Mars again. But we're building up the evidence. So it's a little bit like a detective kind of providing clues. So we've had all this orbital imagery, but we've never actually had any evidence from real rocks. So this is the first time we've had evidence from real rocks of particles being transported by water. And then what it allows you to do is very cleverly is make estimates. You know, these are back-of-the-envelope calculations, but we know something about the flow velocities, the shear stresses required to lift pebbles up into a water flow. So we can actually back calculate what the water velocities were. And we sort of, you know, it's very rough and ready, but we estimate that these ancient Martian rivers were at this location were flowing at sort of walking pace. And we think that the water depths may have been ankle to hip deep.
That's incredible that you can tell that from observations that far away of pebbles inside another rock.
Yeah, I mean, the key thing is that physics works on Earth and Mars. It's no different. And we have all this knowledge and we can do it. I mean, it's something that I do with my first year students. We look at some in the field, we look at some class and we estimate the flow velocities, and we're just applying this to another planet. And, you know, what was interesting is that we didn't have some of our highest resolution cameras working when we passed these things. So we're looking forward. We're now driving back towards the mountain and hopefully going to pass some more of these rocks and look at them.
That's brilliant. And you said that's coming out really soon, that paper.
The paper's just come out. It was in Science in late May. So that's out and you can read that. And the other result has been actually from our drilling activity. So we drove to this place where we could see these beautiful layered sediments. We call this place Yellowknife Bay. Always hopeful. And, you know, the debate on the team had been, are these volcanic lava flows, which wouldn't be of much interest for habitability and, you know, biosignatures, whatever, or were they sedimentary deposits? And what we discovered were, again, that these layers were made up of sandstones, so sand turned into rock that's been transported by rivers, we believe. And then we found these mudstones, and mudstones are very, very fine-grained rocks. And they usually form from very fine clay particles falling out of suspension in a standing water body. So we've analysed these rocks, and we think that they're an ancient, very shallow lake, perhaps. And we drilled these rocks. And so, again, as I mentioned, this is the first time we've ever drilled on another planet, and we've got some beautiful results. So firstly, we get the general chemistry. So we've drilled two drill holes, and we get this general chemistry of basaltic planet. But in addition, what we've discovered is, from the ChemIn results, from the X-ray diffraction, is that these rocks also contain about 30% clay minerals. And clay minerals are very interesting, because clays, these are smectite clays, clays are hydrated minerals. So they've got water molecules attached to them, and what they tell us is about this past aqueous environment. And clay minerals on Earth form as a result of weathering of rocks. You know, they're the most abundant minerals on Earth because we have an abundant water cycle on Earth. So what we believe that these clay minerals are formed from is weathering due to a water cycle. Probably not huge, not like Earth, but at least, you know, some water flowing on the surface of Mars that has weathered basalt to clay minerals. And, you know, whilst we've detected clay minerals in other places on Mars from orbit, that's an orbital observation. That's never been ground truth, and this is the first ground truth thing of clay minerals. So that's a hugely exciting result. And it's important also for this search for life, because organic matter can be preserved in clay minerals, and so that's a good place to potentially find evidence for complex organic compounds.
So that's really the place for that to be focused.
Yes.
Wow, those are two incredible results that have happened so quickly. I mean, it's only been up there for a year. So what do you have planned for the future with this rover?
Well, today's actually quite an exciting day. It's Wednesday, the 3rd of July, and we are hopefully beginning our big drive. So the last 3 weeks we've been working on an outcrop called Shayla, and I've been leading large parts of that. It's been really exciting 3 weeks. We've worked really hard and we've got absolutely amazing data. But this is the last outcrop for some time that we're going to do really detailed science on. Our goal now is to drive to the foothills of Mount Sharp, this 5 kilometer high mountain, because there are some really interesting features there. In the foothills we have rock layers that we can detect clay minerals and sulfate minerals from orbit, so they must be in high abundance. And this is very exciting because, firstly, clays tell us there was a lot of water, sulfates tell us there was less water. So perhaps this is recording an ancient environmental change, maybe a past climate change on Mars, and we'd like to reconstruct this. Now, it's about 10 kilometres away, but it's going to take us many, many months to drive there, and we've decided that we're just going to drive there straight, and we're not going to look at random things on the way. We may have a few stops, but most of it's, you know, putting our foot down and really, really driving and getting there. So today is the beginning of that adventure.
Well, I hope everything goes absolutely perfectly with the long drive and everything. And yeah, I hope curiosity keeps creating lots more science and scientific results. So thank you very much for telling us all about curiosity.
Thank you very much indeed. That was excellent.